You're listening to a very special bonus episode of Basgasten, in which I talk to the great Tal Wolkenveld. Tal is known for her work with musicians like Herbie Hancock and Jeff Beck, and can of course also be heard on the newly released Prince album, Welcome to America. I spoke to Tal about those records, about her gear, and of course her solo album, so enjoy this very special bonus episode of Basgasten with Tal Wolkenveld.
Let's do this.
Yeah, great. Well, it's amazing that you could find time to do this. I mean, I can imagine with the new Prince album that you have a lot of stuff to do.
Yeah, there's a lot of promo going on, but I'm happy to do it.
Great. I want to talk about the Prince album a little later on, but my podcast has a bit of a, it doesn't have a structure, but I always have a couple of questions I want to ask my guests. And the first one I really want to ask you is, do you remember what your first bass was?
Yes. It was, I guess it was like a Squire, like a $300 Squire with like, it came with an amp and strap and stuff.
Right. The standard like starter pack Squire bass.
Yeah.
So and then what made you like pick the bass as such? Because I believe you were quite young.
Oh no, I was old. I was like 17 when I switched to the bass. I started guitar when I was 14.
Right.
Yeah.
So was there like a specific moment where you thought, "Oh, wait a second, this bass is something new or something better or extra than guitar?"
I guess I was more attracted to the role of being a bass player. It made more sense to me, like in a band situation, I wanted to be the one like laying down the groove and like, you know, have more responsibility of how the groove felt and the time felt. And I loved drums too, but I also loved playing a harmonic instrument. I mean, not that drums isn't harmonic, obviously it is, but you know, like notes that or on a fretboard. So it seemed like a good balance.
So, and then the Squire was the first bass. And I think most people know you from your Sadowski bass. Can you tell a little bit about how that bass came to be or how your love for Sadowski?
Yeah, well, I moved to America when I was 16 as a guitarist. And then I started practicing like from 30 minutes a day in Australia, which is all I was allowed to do. I went to like 5 hours a day when I went to America, like, yes, I can play all the time now. Ha ha ha. And then I got tendonitis and I couldn't play. So I had a bunch of months where I was just sitting around and playing drums with one hand and trying to play bass with one hand and stuff. And that's kind of when I made the decision that I was destined to be more of a bass player. And so when when the tendonitis went away, I moved full time to focusing on the bass at the same school for 6 months. And then I moved to New York. But while I was still in LA, I went to the NAMM show and started playing a bunch of basses at different booths, and Sadowski, and I got along great, and I loved his instruments, and that's kind of how it all got started.
You mentioned you are allowed to practice for 30 minutes a day.
Yeah.
How does a thing like that happen?
Just strict parenting. You know, like I came from parents who like were into academia. I mean, not like in some sort of crazy way, but it's just kind of how they thought that was a smart move to focus on my schoolwork. And I agree with them. Now being my age, I'm like, yeah, they're probably right. I mean, the music industry is one of the toughest industries to break into and survive in. And we're all learning that now in COVID. It's like, it's just almost impossible.
Yeah. Yeah, many musicians took on like regular jobs.
Yeah. I mean, and also people with regular jobs are suffering tremendously. I mean, in so many industries. But yeah, I mean, it's so hit and miss with the music business. So I understand why they wanted me to focus. And
liberating when you went to America, like, all right, now I have like my own place and my own time.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when you're that age, it's like if you're passionate about something, at least for me, I couldn't think about anything else other than music. I was obsessed. Like so obsessed that I was blind to everything else. And like I've had to work on that in my life. Like, okay, like there's more to life than music, Tal, you know, especially being a songwriter now, like singing and writing lyrics. You know, you're writing about life, so you need to live life to write about life.
Well, I want to know all about your latest solo record in a bit. But first, are you a gearhead? Like, do you have a big collection of basses? Or are you more a person that goes, yeah, I have two or three great basses and that's all I need?
I started with the idea in my brain that I should be able to play anything on my one instrument. And for the first half of my career, I played everything on that four-string maple Sadowski. And then eventually, as I started making more records, that's when I realized, well, no, hold on a second. Like, it's okay. Like, you should get into all kinds of other sounds, and every song calls for something a little bit different. It's not like I couldn't do it all on one bass, but different basses offer different things, and I enjoyed exploring that. So now, you know, I have a couple of EB2 basses, which are great for some situations, and I have a harmony bass. I have a P bass, which I play more than anything, really. Yeah, it's the most versatile bass, a P bass, still, I feel.
I think a lot of people will go, no, it's a jazz bass because it has two pickups and your Sadowski has a preamp and you can do anything on it. But for you, it's the P.
Yeah, it's the P bass.
The P is like a late or early 70s or late 60s?
It's a 69.
Right. It's original, I think, right?
Yeah, it's all original.
Do you care about authenticity and originality in old basses? You mentioned you have a couple of EB2s and a harmony.
Yeah, I care about that. I happened to buy this harmony off somebody I know in LA for $500. They were going pretty cheap. In the last few years, they've kind of gone up.
Yeah, it's the vintage craze, right?
Yeah.
You mentioned you developed tendonitis when you were practicing maybe a bit too much at once. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of musicians also struggle with tendonitis, myself included. I had it in both my left wrist and my right hand. How did you deal with that except for not doing anything? Did you have exercises, or was it just keep your rest and wait for it to go away?
Yeah, more the latter. I just waited. There was like a hand physical therapist that I went to 3 or 4 times, and he showed me a couple of like exercises in like a bucket of water with a squishy ball. I didn't do it that much though, but it may have helped. It's mainly the rest, I think, you know?
Must have been agonizing.
It was tough. But I think it was necessary for me because it gave me some time to reflect on this huge decision I'd made. You know, had I not had that time, I just kind of would have got swooped up in the music business and like sort of not really processed the fact that I'd just left my family and friends and moved to the other side of the world to pursue a music career, which may or may not ever happen. So it was good. And I was also at that time focusing on lyrics and writing songs, so yeah, it was a useful time for me.
Mm-hmm. And you already talk about writing songs and lyrics a couple times now, but I think many people knew you were writing lyrics and songs like by your second studio album, like your second solo album in 2019. So have you been writing for all those years you've been in the States and then adding that up to an album? Or did you write stuff for that record?
I started when I first started guitar when I was 14, writing songs with lyrics. And then when I switched to the bass, I kind of stopped that. And part of it was that I wanted to put all my attention into one thing, which was just like learning the bass inside and out. And I didn't want anything to distract me from that. And then once I felt like I'd spent enough time doing that with the bass, that's when I started to come back around to like, okay, now I can focus again on lyrics. I'd been writing the whole time, but I wrote instrumental music. They're still writing. But now for the last, I suppose, 6 or 7 years, my focus has been on words. You know, I guess it's just part of my personality that I like to like focus on one thing at a time. Yeah.
So when you started out playing bass at age 14, who were the main, were you like listening to bass players or was?
Oh, you mean guitar? When I played guitar?
No. When you switched to bass a couple of years later.
Oh, when I was 17. Yeah.
Who were the guys that were in your like point of view, as in those are the guys I'm listening to and I'm getting inspired by? And
I was really inspired by drummers at first because I was like obsessed with drums. And so when I switched from guitar to bass and I was auditioning for the bass department at the school, like for a scholarship, the first song I learned was The Black Page, but on the bass. Yeah, because I was like super into like polyrhythmic stuff and, you know, and so then I quickly got into like jazz fusion music and I was listening to Vinnie Colaiuta and people started calling me Mini Vinnie on the bass. It was pretty funny. And then I met him like 2 months later at the school because there was a drummer named Vito who came and did a clinic and he didn't bring a band with him and asked the director of the school like, hey, can you pick your favorite bassist and guitarist to accompany him? And they chose me and they chose a guitarist and we accompanied him. And then that was Vinny's like very good friends with this guy. And so that's when I first met him. But then we didn't play. We reconnected when I came back to LA after New York. At that time, I'd only been playing for like maybe two months.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm still trying to get my head over The Black Page on bass. Did you have to arrange that yourself or how did that work?
Yeah, I just sort of transcribed it.
And then gave it pitch.
No, it has pitch.
Oh, right. I found a transcription as well. Yeah. Wow. That must have been I know a lot of...
The bass teachers were looking at me like, how about some Earth, Wind, and Fire, Tal?
How about not going off and just play bass?
Yeah, right. I mean, I was just obsessed with rhythm. But then I, you know, listening to that kind of music, I got very much into Anthony Jackson. He quickly became one of my favorites. I also, at the NAMM show, when I met Sadowski, I met Marcus Miller there too. And I'd been listening to him for a while and we got together and played and he gave me some tips. So he was definitely influencing me. And when I moved to New York, that's kind of when Anthony Jackson started mentoring me on a weekly basis.
That must have been very special.
It was special, yeah. But we never, like, maybe like once or twice we sat down with our basses. But other than that, it was just sitting in his car for like hours every week, just talking about music and listening to records. And he'd be like, you know, you see how the bass player would just pull back just slightly on beat two of that phrase. Now, if you were to play that, what would you do? And like, what do you think of this tone? And like, we just go on and on and on, like analyzing. That's how kind of how I learned how to play, you know.
Just listening and thinking about.
And talking, yeah.
The situation.
Yeah, analyzing. And also he gave me like pep talks, you know, like he'd be like, I'd be real hard on myself, especially in those days when I was just learning because I had such high expectations of myself. And he'd be like, and he came to all of my little gigs that I was doing, like he would be like sitting in the front row. And I'd do all my gigs where I'd be writing my own music, like the stuff that's on my first album, Transformation. He was just there for every gig. And I'd get sad after the gig, like, oh, I could have done better and this and that. And he's like, now, in the words of Steve Gadd, he used to tell me, on your worst day, you're still a bad mother. Mm-mm.
I think many bassists would, like, be super nervous if you are at a small gig and there were only a couple of people there maybe, and then Anthony Jackson walks in.
he was like my cheerleader,
but he's still Anthony Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
I think every wrong or like misplaced note, you know, he would hear it and he'd probably tell you if that's the way if you're friendly like that, he would probably tell you next time, like, you remember that G and bar two and the third beat? The G sharp.
He never criticized me. He would just ask me questions. Like, he was just really supportive.
Wow. So, and you also talked about Marcus Miller. What was the best advice he gave you?
Oh my gosh, we're going back so many years. I really don't remember. I've like internalized what my mentors have taught me, you know? Like you get to that point where you forget how you learned how to spell enthusiastic. You just know how to spell it. It's kind of the same thing. It's not that the information's lost. It's just a part of me now.
It's not a literal thing like, okay, you told me this and this. It's just kind of everywhere.
Yeah, you accumulate the experience and the wisdom, or you hope you do.
You talked about Vinnie Kaliura, and I asked my audience if they have questions for you. And Rogier is a great guy, great bass player, amazing bass player. And he asked, I saw a video of you playing with Herbie Hancock. I think many people know those videos. And you're playing with Vinnie Kaliura as well. He says, how do you keep up with a rhythmic phenomenon like Kaliura? I mean, you play with so many amazing drummers. And when I listen to Vinny, I'm lost at moments. Like, really lost. Like, I've lost the one, any pulse. Do you consciously keep up or just kind of feel where it's going?
Both. I mean, I can feel the subdivisions in what he's doing. He's not like, you know, someone like Elvin, for instance, where it's like swimming over the time. It's like Vinny's very precise. Like every subdivision is pretty much what it is. So maybe just listening to him a lot and like analyzing things like that Zappa wrote helped.
So it's just like getting used to his playing, and then can you predict what he's gonna do?
No. He's always creating like fresh. It's not about predicting. It's just I can feel the pulse underneath what he's doing.
I think many people will have heard your name maybe for one of the first times when you're playing with Jeff Beck. And you've been playing with so many amazing artists. Over the years, I can imagine the first time an artist like Jeff calls you, you think it's a joke. How did that work? I mean, if he would call me like, yeah, you're Jeff Beck, right? And I'm Santa Claus.
Not really, because I knew that I was getting the call from his management. It wasn't like Jeff Beck just called me out the blue. Whereas when Prince called me, Prince called me out the blue.
Yeah, I read it in the in a Rolling Stone article that you were playing. He was playing at a party in his house, and that was the first time you met him.
No. Well, the first time we met in person, but the first time he called me, I answered the phone, and the first thing that came out of his mouth wasn't, hey, how are you? It was, do you like the drum rolls of Jack DeJohnette? I was like, well, yeah, who doesn't?
And who is this?
And who is this? So, yeah, I think I've heard stories that he asks peculiar yet relevant questions to people when he first connects with them.
So, but when did you realize it was actually Prince?
Instantly, because someone that worked for him said, oh, he's going to be calling you at some point today. Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
I mean, imagine you get a phone call from Prince out of the blue. Like, hey, this is, do you like the drum rolls of Jack DeJohnette? I got hang up instantly.
Apparently that happened to a keyboard player of his named Xavier. Like, apparently he cold called him, and then I think he may have hung up. I don't remember the story exactly.
So the main reason we are talking now, I think, is the release of the, well, let's call it new Prince record out July 30th. What was it like having made that record and then not releasing it 10 years ago?
I don't expect people to release music when I make music with them. I've done so many recordings where it's like it sits on a shelf. And it's not till I see it being advertised that I'm like, oh, great, they're releasing it. I did this amazing project, for instance, with Joe Walsh, Ringo Starr, Jim Keltner, Mick Jagger, Dr. John, Bill Withers. I mean, there was like this never-ending list of amazing humans in one room, and that's on a shelf somewhere. So I've just come to expect when I go into a session, I give it my all, and the artist will do what they do with it. And when they start advertising, I get excited. But I don't get excited until it's advertised. So I never expected this to come out.
That's amazing, like, expectancy management. Never
right.
Never able to be released except when it's released.
Yeah, I have to curb my enthusiasm. Da-doom-tsh.
So, but then, have you like, because, I mean, working with amazing musicians is great, but somehow in my head, working with Prince is like one level above everybody else. So when I would, if I would do a session with Prince, I would still be a little bit disappointed that it wouldn't be released.
I mean, I guess that's if you're doing a session to see a result. But like, whatever I do in life, I hope I'm not doing it for the result of it. I'm doing it just to do it. And then what happens, happens. So, yeah, I really wasn't expecting anything. I was just having fun in the session. And we met in 2008. I'd been playing with Jeff for about a year at that point. And when he first called me, he said that him and Larry Graham had been watching my YouTube videos on repeat. And he then invited me to go over to his place. And that's when, you know, the first time I showed up and it was a party, but I was the only audient. Everyone else was just playing with him in his band. And then he decided to play Stratus with me, I think because he's seen me play with Jeff Beck. And we jammed on that, and I came back a few times. Another time I just showed up and there was a limo in the driveway, and I was like, well, where are we going? And he's like, well, we're not really going anywhere. We're just going to drive around and listen to music. And then we just listened to all these artists, and it was a very similar kind of conversation to that which I had with Anthony Jackson. Like, so what do you think of this artist? And what do you think about what they did here? I'm like, oh, this sounds familiar. Yeah. And then the next year, me, Prince, and John Blackwell got together in a rehearsal space and were jamming and making stuff up just like as a trio. And then maybe 6 months later, he called me up and said, hey, so I want to make a trio with you. And I know you're particular about the drummers you like to play with, so I want you to pick the drummer. And I was like, okay, great. So I called like 4 different drummers up and I was like, hey, you want to come and jam? And I didn't tell them what it was for, because I figured if they didn't want to come and jam, then they're not the right personality for this type of situation. It's got to be someone that just wants to have some fun and make some music and also is badass. So luckily, all 4 of them said yes. And then I sent 2 of the 4 to Prince. And then Prince chose Chris Coleman. And then within a few weeks, he flew us both out to Minneapolis. It was Chris's first time, my second time, because I went there once with John Blackwell. And we were in a rehearsal space playing and jamming. And then the very next time after that, we were in the studio making Welcome to America.
Like, yeah. Wow. Are you that particular with playing with the drummers you're playing? I mean,
oh, yeah.
You're playing with amazing drummers, of course. But are you?
Yeah, I'm spoiled.
Of course, yeah. So, this was it first the being particular or the being spoiled? What came first in your experience?
I think probably being particular, but not just specifically with drummers, with all music. I think in order to develop your own sound on your instrument, you need to be particular to know what you like and don't like, and that's how you hone in on a sound.
So what would you describe as your ideal drummer? You don't have to name names, but if you have to like write out a perfect drummer for you,
yeah, I think it's genre specific too. You know, I don't necessarily think that one drummer fits all. Like, you know, if I had to go to a desert island and choose one meal, no matter if it's my favorite meal, I'd still get sick of it after 3 days and it's not going to tick all the boxes. So, you know, when I'm making records, I think about whose sound do I want to hear on this song? Do I want tacos? Do I want burgers? Do I want pasta? It's all different.
So how did you end up with the musicians for your solo album? I mean, when you're playing with somebody else, maybe except for the Prince gig where you got to pick the drummer. If you're playing for somebody else, the drummer and the guitar player and such are already there. But when you're making a solo record, it's your record.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
You probably know so many great drummers, guitar players, and so on and so on. How do you pick the musicians you play with on that record?
For Love Remains, it was Gourmet Pizza. I was like, let me find the musicians that sound like Gourmet Pizza. I wanted to find musicians that really played for the song, which, you know, Love Remains is multi-genre, but it's very much influenced by, you know, rock and folk and a little bit of jazz and blues, and I guess alternative or indie. I mean, it's hard to kind of nail it down, but I wanted musicians that could harmonically and rhythmically stretch further than boundaries that are usually around, you know, a standard folk or rock song, but still authentically play that style of music. And Paul and Jeremy Stacey, Paul Stacey produced the album with me and Jeremy played drums, that they can play jazz, they can play rock, they can play anything. They have really good aesthetic. And so I chose them, and I chose Blake Mills on guitar, who can also play anything. Like harmonically, he's extremely versatile. He also always plays for the song and comes up with something unique and original. And then on keyboards, Zach Ray and Ben Montench, I felt the same way about. They're all just, they can play anything and still play for the song. So that was my main priority for this record. And people that had some grit to them, you know, like not too pristine and precise. I wanted this record to have some grit.
It's funny that you mentioned all those musicians that also have a very distinct sound. I mean, you can recognize Blake's playing anytime. He can play anything, but it will always sound like Blake Mills, which is awesome because that's what you want to hear. It's funny because I spoke to Pino Palladino a couple of months ago, who of course also made a solo record with Blake Mills.
Yeah.
You can hear that Blakey sound through those two records, which is really awesome because that's the guy you would want to have on your record. I also thought that there is one track on the record, well, at least one track, the title track, where you don't play bass because Blake played it.
Yeah.
How does that work? Like being a great bass player and then having somebody else play bass on your track?
Well, I decided when starting this record and during the record, because it was still developing in real time while making it, that this was a record about my songs, or focused on my songs, not focused on my bass playing. Even though there are some songs like Haunted Love, which is just bass and voice and it features the bass, or Under the Sun has a little bit of like a solo-y intro and outro. But generally speaking, that was all, even the stuff that features the bass is complementing the song and the songs coming first. So that being said, Paul and I decided this record was going to be best tracked live in the studio. And we tracked it as a trio, like me, Jeremy, Stacey, and Blake. There were a couple days that Zach Ray came in and played with us, but most of it was the trio. And so I would play whatever instrument that I wrote the song on. So for Love Remains, it was guitar. And so then Blake played bass. And for Corner Painter, it was also a baritone guitar. And so Blake played guitar, but a baritone guitar. And we decided it didn't really need bass. And I ended up playing like some bass notes on an organ just to like fatten it up. But it didn't need a bass line. It was really full. So I think like, when you record as an ensemble, that can generally just dictate what the how the record's going to develop. I had the same experience with Prince because, you know, Prince wanted to make a trio. And so when we went in the studio, we cut everything as a trio. I was on bass, Chris on drums, and Prince on guitar. And then that was how the whole record was made, and everything, like all the vocals and then the keyboards, were then layered on top of that. But, you know, the trio kind of dictated what space was already being taken up, you know? So
I've heard the record, and it also really sounds like that trio is very tight, and then all the other instruments and backing vocals like adapt to that timing.
Yeah. Well, we didn't like record to a click or anything. It was like all to tape. And also, there was no rehearsal of the songs. It was extremely quick. It was like, you know, he'd be like, okay, so the verse is going to be these chords, and then we'll hit the chorus and then back to the verse, and then I'll cue you for the bridge. I don't know how long it'll be, but we'll figure it out. Okay, roll the tape. And then it was like, go. There was no rehearsal. I just made up everything on the spot, and maybe we'd do a second take, and that was it. The whole record.
It feels a bit strange to me because in my head, Prince has always been really like precise and meticulous about his records and how it should sound and how the band should play. But maybe that's a wrong impression I have of him.
I've heard the same thing, and it sounds like that's what he's done in the past, and perhaps he wanted to do something different with us, because when he called me and said he wanted to make a trio, he was referencing Hendrix Trio and talking about my work with Jeff Beck. So, you know, both of those outfits are a lot looser and like raw and spontaneous, and I think he wanted to give that a go. And so, yeah, it's kind of what it sounds like.
You've already mentioned that you need musicians that just make a song better. Is that also because I've one listener's question says, what's the essence of a good bass part for you? And I've had many conversations with bass players, and many of them just say a bass part that makes the song better. Is that the same for you?
Yeah, and I would add that the bass line is in some way a counter melody. Even if you're just hitting root notes, you know, I try to go for something that someone would want to sing, that someone could sing. And that, you know, yeah, it could be the simplest thing. But I try to make everything as melodic as possible.
Yeah. So do you, when you think of bass lines, like, for example, for your first record, do you sing them first, or is it really like a playing thing?
It's kind of happening together and then also very quickly back and forth, like a computer kind of keeps going back and forth when processing multiple things. It's like, you know, you're hearing something and then you're also like changing it in real time and hearing more. And like, I don't know, it's hard to explain that process. It's kind of instinctual.
It just happens.
Yeah, I guess.
Speaking of singing, it's a returning theme on the podcast. Many bass players think playing bass and singing is very hard. Please tell my listeners that it's not and how it works.
I guess hard is relative, right? I mean,
he literally asks, only a few bass players can sing and play bass at the same time. Phil Lynott, Mark King, Geddy Lee, to name a few, and Tal can do too. Question number one, does she adjust her playing to her voice? And question two is, why am I and 90% of other bass players unable to do it?
I think I could suggest some exercises that work. Like, try playing a bass line that continually repeats and then have someone in the room with you and have a conversation. That works really well, because you're not really talking in beats and in something that's grooving. Try to talk like it's spoken word on the top of a groove, and make sure you don't change it. And then do the same with singing, but now sing in time over it, but just improvise. And then if there's something that makes you mess up the bass line, then repeat that thing that made you mess it up until you can learn to coordinate whatever that thing is with your bass. And then it's just a process of elimination. Like, the more that you can not have a hiccup while doing something different with your voice, it's just the same as drumming. You know, like, you're just trying to coordinate different things happening at once. And you, if you can't do it, you strip it down. You just do the bass drum pattern. Then you add the snare. Then you add the hi-hat. Then you add whatever else is going on. Like, one step at a time, and you keep just breaking it down. I think that can help. So no, I don't adapt the bass to the voice any more than I would if there was a separate singer from bass player. I'm always making the bass complement what the voice is doing. And I tend to kind of stretch out more, or maybe I'll do a fill or something, like when there is no vocal, because I'm not trying to pull focus from the vocal. So it's very similar, or if not the same, approach.
You made a drumming analogy again. which is great. Are you a drummer? Can you play drums?
Yeah, I love playing drums. I don't play them as often as I wish I could, just because of time. But I think it's important for bass players to be able to play guitar and drums, and keyboards, which I'm terrible at. But I think that with those four instruments, no matter which of those four you play, it's really handy to play all of the other three.
Yeah, but
except if you're a keyboard player, then it's like you don't really need to play bass or guitar because you kind of have it all there. But drums, I think, is helpful for keyboard players because of just the groove and the feel and stuff like that.
Yeah, maybe not even be able to play it, but know what happens what a drummer does. Like, be able to tell a drummer, okay, if you play this pattern.
Yeah, but it's like, when I'm making records, I really try the best that I can to shy away from telling the drummer exactly what to do, because I'm kind of like limiting them creatively. Although it's hard for me because I get very specific ideas in my head, but I try not to do that. I think the experience of playing the drums helps your playing be better on the instrument. You don't, regardless of whether you talk to a drummer about what they're doing or not, just for your own brain.
So feel what a drummer is feeling, basically, when...
Like, the way that I play drums with my hands influences how I play the bass with my hands. It's like you're still playing the time with hands, you know?
I saw one instrument on your solo record that I really want to know how and why and how to not get blisters on your thumbs. You played kalimba on one thing after another. Now, I've tried to play kalimba, but after like 20 minutes, my thumbs were like dead and I had blisters everywhere and it was bleeding. Did you practice that a lot?
No, I just played it for 5 minutes and recorded it and that was the end of it.
Yeah, so it was a bit cheating. No, it wasn't cheating. So, and how did you, at the beginning of the conversation, you mentioned the COVID situation. I don't really know what the current situation is in America, but here I had a gig today, which is the last one until October or something, because everything got canceled. How did you make sure to like stay inspired and productive without any audiences to play for?
I get a lot of inspiration from just writing songs. So I've just continued to do that, and I'm just building up catalogs of music, most of which will probably end up on my solo records. And I've just set up like a outdoor area where I can collaborate with people, so it's like COVID safe, and that's been fun. It's actually been really fun to like write music with people outside.
But how does writing music about life work if life is not happening?
Well, life is happening. Life just kind of is shit right now for a lot of people. It's still life. It's just not an ideal situation, you know? So in a way, there's more to talk about.
I got to let that sink in for a minute. There's not much happening, so there's more to think about.
Well, you're saying there's not much happening. You mean like that... Shows are being stopped and social events are being stopped, but people aren't stopping their lives. Their lives are still continuing, and there's even more stress, financial stress and family stress and all kinds of stress that you can be writing about.
So the next Tol Wilkenfeld solo record is a financial stress record.
It's actually I feel like it's more political than anything I've ever done. Which is interesting, you know, this The Prince record is extremely political.
Yeah, like, I think it might be the most political record he's ever made.
Yeah, I am such a fan. Like, these lyrics are outstanding.
Yeah.
So inspiring and so relevant to right now.
It's weird. I was listening to it the other day, and I know it's from, I think it's, you recorded it in 2010.
Yeah.
I was like, this could have made like last month.
I know.
Both I know.
Stylistic and lyrically.
Yeah. Well, it's hard to not have a trio sound timeless because it's like, it's so stripped down, you know? But to have lyrics be that timeless is like, wow, it's, I mean, I guess it's all a challenge, but when something is as raw with not layered with production that kind of gives it a time period, I feel like it's easy. Like, I still listen to like Hendrix and it sounds timeless, you know?
Oh yeah, totally. So, and you recorded that album in 2010. How long had you not heard it before you heard that it was going to be released like this year?
Well, after we recorded it in March and April of 2010, we had listening parties. Prince like flew us out in May of 2010 and played us the finished record. So we heard it then. And then I didn't hear it till like January of this year.
Were you surprised that it was still there, or that it sounded like you were like, did I play this? I don't remember any of this stuff.
It was a shock. My friend Matthew Bitton, who did a lot of photography for Prince, called me up and I was like, hey, this sounds like you. And he played me Same Page, Different Book, which is the one that has like all those bass fills on it. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, yeah, well, I can hear it's you. It's, you know, you get a sound. And that, I just was like giggling listening to that over the phone, because I just remember like sitting on the edge of my seat, and like he just quickly said, okay, and go to this chord, to this chord, and da, 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 let's go. And then in the middle of the take, he'd point to me and said, bass fill. And like, and then he did it again, the second time. And then the third time. And by the fourth time, I was like laughing so much that this was happening that you'll notice on the fourth time, I didn't play anything because I was just giggling. And then the last time it happened, I played a fill again. But it was just so hilarious to me. And that's what was kept on the record.
And so your friend said, you have a sound. What is the Tal Wilkenfeld sound? Because if I listen to your solo records, I hear that bridge pickup Sadowski on Transformation. And then there's the grumpy low end groovy P bass on Love Remains. So what for you is the Tal Wilkenfeld sound?
I mean, I think the sound is not really so much about the instrument as much as it is about what you choose to play where, and that can sort of be played across any kind of instrument. So that would be for other people to decide if they can recognize my playing, no matter what instrument I'm playing.
But can you recognize yourself? Like, when you heard the record, you're like, oh yeah, that's me. I can hear.
Yeah, I can definitely recognize myself.
So if you can recognize yourself, you can kind of pinpoint where that recognition comes from, right?
Yeah, but it's more of a feeling kind of a recognition to me. It's not like, oh, I recognize that's me because I played the minor third on the beat two of the. It's not that kind of recognition. It's like when you listen to your own voice being recorded. It's like, yeah, that's me. Well, why is it you? I don't know. It just sounds like me. That's my voice. I don't know why.
So, and in a way, yeah, and especially for you, your bass is, because you're so vocal in playing, and you use your voice in writing and thinking of bass lines in the same way you use your bass. That might be why it sounds like you.
Yeah, it's like just part of the composition.
Yeah. It still must have been weird. Someone else is going like, yeah, that's you. I can hear it.
It's a nice compliment. Like, it's one of the nicest compliments, really, to be like, yeah, I sounds like you. It's like, oh, well, that's nice. Like,
but it's not something you're consciously like.
No, I'm not striving to be different. I'm just striving to be the most like authentic version of myself. And that's done through just freely and truly expressing what's real to you in any given moment.
That's like a quote anyone can have on their wall. So what's up next for you now? Because I mean, the record is released July 30th, but unfortunately there's no tour because there's no Prince anymore.
Yeah. I mean, he asked me to do the tour for this album back in 2010, but I was already touring with Jeff and Herbie, so it didn't happen. Something that I'll always be sad about, that we didn't get to like finish the project. Cause you know, it's like the last step is like you make the music and then you tour it. Like, so we didn't get to fulfill that part of the journey together. And yeah, it's in a way this album coming out is healing and is giving me the closure that I never really had. I mean, it'll never be full closure, but it's definitely a step in a more healing direction.
Yeah. Yeah. It must have been so weird. Well, especially for me, like not being a musician that's touring with Herbie Hancock and Jeff Beck, having to say no to Prince because you're playing with Herbie Hancock. Have you ever realized the privilege you're having in moments like that?
Yeah, always. It's a rare, rare privilege. And I continue to pinch myself, not just about the musicians that I've got to work with, but just the amazing friends I have in my life and just the kind of situations that I've been able to be a part of, like even just hanging with all the comedians that I hang out with that bring me so much joy and laughter, got me through that tough period when not just Prince that passed away, but I had a series of friends and mentors, and people I respect that just all left the planet one after the other in a very short period of time. And my comedian friends got me through that time. And I feel like it really, really changed me. It deepened me by lightening me up, you know. And now, I mean, I've always loved comedy. And I like the idea of being able to laugh at anything. But to really kind of understand and study by just being a fan and watching comedy, that's really helped, like, me as a songwriter, as a person. So I'm excited for this next album that I'm working on. I'm actually working on several albums because I've just been writing nonstop and they're all like stylistically very different. But my writing has developed and changed, especially lyrically, just from everything that I've experienced in the last 5 years or so.
So how would you say it has? I mean, you said my next album might be a little bit more political.
Yeah, it is, because when I listen to Love Remains, that there are many of those songs that are kind of focused on heartbreak and inner turmoil and dealing with shadows. And this record is a bit more, I suppose, observational of what's happening around me as well. So, yeah, not every song, like, but a larger number of the songs.
Right. So we can expect a couple of albums coming out in the next
I mean, I don't know when it'll come out. That part I have to figure out, like the business side of things and stuff. I haven't even thought about that. I'm just sort of focusing on finishing this music. But yeah, I suppose within the year or two.
And then hopefully touring. That would be great.
Right. It would be.
So do you still have some tours in the planning, or is it just waiting and see what
happens? I'm told that like the soonest things will really start happening is next year.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, there'll be scattered things at the end of this year, but it's all question marks right now.
Yeah, I think everybody knows and everybody feels it.
Yeah.
Hey, Tal, I'm super honored you wanted to talk to me for almost an hour. It's been a great honor. Yeah, good luck with the new music. I really enjoyed the Prince album. I think I'm going to listen to it like 100 more times and like pinpoint the fourth bass lick. Well, the absence of the fourth lick.
Yeah.
Yeah. See if I can hear a giggle in the faint distance.
Right.
And well, hopefully see you on tour soon somewhere.
Yeah. Thank you. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you too. It's been great talking to you.
Okay, bye.
All right. Thank you. Bye-bye.
You are listening to a very special bonus episode of Basgasten with Tal Wilkenfeld. Basgasten is made by me, Hidderorda. Music is by Tyranny Flock. And Basgasten is powered by The Bassist, the magazine for the Dutch and Belgian bass player. Check out Basgasten on Facebook and Spotify and Instagram. And don't forget to subscribe in your favorite podcast platform.